This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Trouble with the Victorians, How a Single Era Shaped Our Opinions.
So I'm really excited for this week.
I sent Madeleine a suggestion. She's like, what should we do our episode on? I said, how about this? And she's like, okay, I don't even know what that's about yet, and I'm already really excited.
Yeah, you literally sent me The Trouble with Victorians, and I was like, oh, I'm so down for this.
And I feel like maybe I've given the impression that I have an issue with the Victorian era, and I really, really don't. I think it's fascinating. But there is a big but, unfortunately, and that is
there
are issues in the sense that it's really got a lot to answer for. Anyway, we seem to jostle up against Victorian era stuff a lot in Dissecting Dragons, so we thought it might be interesting to have a look at it properly in a light-hearted manner and just point a finger at places where it's influenced our understanding of things, and sometimes, in fact, often, that understanding is incorrect.
Yeah, because, as you say, pretty much any time any sort of investigation into, history, mythology, fairy tales, literature occurs, there's always a wall, and that wall is the Victorian period.
It really is.
And I feel like a lot of people just hit the wall and go, right, this is where we are. We've reached our destination.
We remember approximately 200 years of history, and everything before that's a big blur. But they must have been kind of like the Victorians, because people didn't progress very fast. The thing is, you have to look, the Victorian era, the time when Queen Victoria ascended the throne in 1837 and ruled until she died on the 22nd of January 1901. Which is almost 64 years, a whopping rule for a single monarch. It really is, particularly considering that, your life expectancy was probably your 3 score years and 10, and it has been through most of history, despite what people say. But particularly in an era, everything before the Victorian era, the chances of you staying on the throne for 6 decades and change is... it's insane. I mean, we have great kings supposedly great kings like Henry V, who managed to rule for only 13 years. So you've got to have a little bit of perspective. Mary I as well. I think she managed, a handful of years, perhaps?
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Is this Mary Tudor?
Yeah, this was not a long period of time, so... So when we talk about the Victorian era, we're talking about 63 years specifically. So it's quite a small period of time in which to influence everything. And yes, lots of big things did happen during the Victorian era, but less than you might think. The other thing is, if you were to take, just take a big pair of metaphorical scissors and cut out 6 decades in one chunk from the 1900s onwards... The change, if you then sliced up those decades, between in 5-year slots, but from decade to decade, things change dramatically. If I just think about the changes that I've seen in the last 4 decades, it's been huge amounts of change in attitudes, in outlook, in things that have happened, in historical events.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing to remember is that the Victorian period... was also that time where there was a revolution of technology, and not just technology, but discovery, science. It all happened in a very short period of time. It's like someone hit the accelerator and we've kind of slowed down really since. We've just been speeding on ahead.
Yeah, definitely. It's really noticeable. There is a lot of speculative fiction that is either influenced by, inspired by, or even set in the Victorian era. It's great. It's a brilliant rich environment and setting to put your novel in. It really is. And the best bit is there are so many historical records. You can read almost anything you want about it. You can find out almost anything you like if you care to. And I can genuinely see the attraction. But you know what? People seem to always pick 1886 to 1900. Without fail, people will pick that those slender decades towards the end of Victoria's reign. And I think a large part of that is the aesthetic. If you think of things like Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, we all love the dresses, no matter how impractical the bustles and curious bodices and excessive corsetry was. We all love what it all looks like. But but at the same time, that's not what everyone wore all the way through the Victorian era. It varied widely. That's kind of like saying, everybody in the 90s was dressed pretty much how they were in the 60s in this last century.
Yeah.
Which we know is not true.
Well, I mean, I just have to compare what people are wearing, like, today that they were, like, 6 years ago.
I mean, admittedly, fashion has got faster, but then that's something that varies, and certainly at the upper echelons of society, which is kind of where people could afford to indulge in fashion. That's something that's been going on since the medieval era. It's just that fashion really wasn't for the lower classes, because who could afford that many clothes?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and also, of course, you have to remember that, mass-produced clothes is, again, a fairly recent phenomenon as well. So everything else did have to be kind of... Well, clothes still have to be made, but they're made with a little bit more ease than they were back then.
Yeah, you're talking about sort of the woolen industry, the mills and what have you. And again, this was a largely sort of late 1800s, late 1700s, early 1800s type thing that carried on well into the Victorian era. Anyway,
absolutely.
Getting a bit off track on our, you know, why are we doing this episode thing. So let's look at some specific issues with why, okay, the Victorian era has influenced our understanding of art, history, literature, and myriad other things. Let's look at why it can be a problem that it has influenced our understanding of history. My big bugbear with this is the fact that people impose or transfer or, you know, assume that the mores and morals and outlook of Victorian society was pretty much what people were thinking for about 4 or 5 centuries before that. And that simply isn't true by any stretch of the imagination. So let's look at a few examples. The Victorians had a very strained attitude towards sex. Certainly the big reforms in the law, which imposed a very deliberate curb on women's sexual freedom and on their reproductive rights and health, happened in the early 1800s. There are various other things that happened to curb women's rights early and were made official bits of legalese during the early 1800s, but we'll get to those in a minute. Prior to the 1800s, it was kind of understood that women would enjoy sex and would actually be kind of relative, you know, you wouldn't discuss it in polite company necessarily, but nobody was expected to not know what it was, or the fact that, well, you did have some ignorant people who genuinely thought, oh, women aren't supposed to enjoy it, and you had the church prattling on because the parts of the church have always been very frightened of sex for some reason. Not all the church, but parts of it. Saying that, you know, this isn't something you should enjoy, it's only for procreation, blah 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 blah. They've been saying that for centuries and nobody has been paying the slightest bit of, you know, attention to that whatsoever. Not really. If you look, you actually do a little bit of digging, you'll find out actually yes, those records have survived because the church wrote a lot.
Yeah.
It's a bit like James Patterson, really. You know, there's more books on the shelf, so you assume that's all there really is in the thriller section, but when you sort of move the books aside a little bit, you find all these other authors who haven't written quite as much, but, you know, still wrote.
Yes.
That's what history's like, strangely enough.
I'm just going to put in a little little note here, which was that the Victorians, and I'm sure you're going to cover this more eloquently than I am, but the Victorians had a very strange way of mythologizing stuff, where they took a lot of information from their history, from folklore, from all of it, and rearranged it to suit them and to only suit them. And the weird part is the things they decided to concentrate on as part of that mythology was this big kind of ceremony around Christianity and around, you know, belief and religion. And I think that that is directly related to the fact that the Victorian period owned half of the world. We stole countries from other people, and we were met with these numerous cultures and religions and beliefs. And instead of sort of opening our minds to the, and I say our like I was there, but instead of the Victorians opening their minds to, you know, this bright new world, instead they decided that they had to kind of find their own identity, and they kind of did it to the max. And this huge sort of very focused view on religion, but particularly the ceremony of religion, was a consequence of that.
Yeah, very definitely. And they had kind of the conqueror's paradox thing going on as well, because in order to maintain a large standing army, you have to give them things to do. And in order to have a large standing army, you must be able to feed them, which means imports if you've got a kingdom the size of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you don't really want to be paying a lot of money for that. So that was partly why the empire was so important. We needed those imports to come in, rightly or wrongly.
Yeah.
And also we needed something to occupy the army and to prove that the queen, you know, in actually what was a very medieval fashion, a medieval mindset, was improving the glory and magnificence of England by conquering and by expanding. That, I mean, that was really quite a dated mindset, and yet it was still perpetuated in the Victorian era. So they had that, but at the same time, this was an age where people were questioning things more. I mean, you, obviously, towards the end of the Victorian era, at the beginning of the Edwardian era, you had the suffragette movement, but the women's rights movement was going for several decades before that, quite comfortably.
Yeah.
In fact, if you want to go back as far as Mary Wollstonecraft, Mary Shelley's mother, she was actually writing things on the rights and liberations of women like centuries before this. So it's not fair to say, you know, we got to 1886 and people started thinking, hang on a minute, women are people too. Because the point was, they've been people all along. And then the early 1800s, some pompous Tory MP said, oh, I don't like the idea of them being able to abort children if they don't want to have them. Let's make it illegal.
Yes.
Among other things. In fact, at the same time, in 1832, that's when it was officially made illegal for women to vote. Before that, women could actually vote, or rather the landholder, the person who had the greatest land share in an area, was able to vote. Now, often that was a man, but not always. Mm-hmm. Sometimes women had control of a property, and as the titular landholder, they would be the one voting in that particular borough. So it really depended on how the boroughs were set up. But in 1832, the men kind of went, no, we don't like that idea. So we'll make it illegal for women to vote. It was at that point illegal for women to hold property as well. So you're looking at, I think, 1876, where the Women's Property Act came in, whereby women over 30 who were unmarried, or married women who were widowed, who were over the age of 21, could in fact inherit property. So I'm not saying the Victorian era was all about sort of the subjugation of women, but it's very noticeable that being able to curb women's rights was put into the judicial system at that time.
Yeah.
And I think
the trouble is, absolutely.
People assume that we had no rights before that, and that's simply not true. Those rights were set up differently and often had a lot more to do with classism than they had to do with sexism, you know, which isn't great, admittedly, but we were valued in a different way, perhaps. So I'm not going to say, yeah, we've had equal rights all along and then the bloody Victorians came along, because that's not what happened.
No.
The Victorian era definitely put a lacquer on the idea of women having any sort of freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also, weirdly enough, put this idea forward that had always, and that there was no, it wasn't just that, no, right, from this point onwards, it was that, no, it's always been this way, which I find really fascinating, because it's just one day, I guess it wasn't one day, but they just sort of decided this, and it's very, it's sort of I can't say the word.
Authoritarian.
There we go. Because it's just, no, it's always been this way, but no, it literally hasn't. The other day we were, no, always been this way. This is the natural order of things. The Victorians were weirdly obsessed with the natural order, probably because, again, it was this time of kind of really learning about the way that the world worked, which it's very interesting because you have this kind of dichotomy between, no, the church is right, and then these, you know, discoveries, you know, in terms of, or theories of evolution, that were so, people were so excited by them, but also were still kind of very stuck in the past, that they were trying to mold them together. And I think a perfect example of that is, you know, just look at, I'm going to say it, the way they looked at fairies.
Yeah.
Where there were studies where they're like, fairies might be a type of insect, like, as in actually, you know, they were really looking at this theory in what they felt was a scientific way, even though it was completely based on sort of fantasy. Again, I don't know, fairies might be real. In fact, I'm pretty sure they are real, but they're definitely not real in the way that the Victorians thought they were. So you've got this really, really weird situation where there's this constant battle between religion, they were so big on mysticism, again, because they were desperately looking for their own identity, so they went back and took the parts of folklore and mythology that they liked, and this new science. And instead of kind of just looking at them all subjectively, they kind of put them all in one giant pot and stirred it a little bit and went, look, Victorians!
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
Yeah, definitely. And as we said, things varied decade on decade, just as they have in every single century ever.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But I think you got really close to something earlier when you were talking about the Victorian tendency to romanticise. And that is essentially what happened. You had this, when all said and done, the UK is a piddly little island, and yet somehow we were ruling 2/3 of the world. And we needed a narrative that would fit that. And we needed the natural order. We needed the natural order whereby women are subservient to men, and white men are superior to men of other ethnicities, for example. But, you know, if you're a decent person, you still treat everybody well, but you acknowledge your own superiority depending on where you are. And somehow we're going to fit God into that equation as well, and science on the other side, and never the twain shall meet. it was this highly romanticized idea of everybody having their place in the world and learning to be satisfied and bending themselves to circumstance. That's the religious side of it. And yet on the other side, if you have a natural superiority of spirit, being able through the medium of sort of scientific understanding, and that doesn't just mean maths and biology, etc., but scientific in the sense of having that analytical and inquiring mind, being able to overcome your circumstances. So you get there's a lot of self-made businessmen in the Victorian era who later went on to become, you know, that they are among the wealthy today. Some of them even gained titles and knighthoods much, much later on, because they were valuable to the economy. So it, as you say, it is a hodgepodge, but what interests me is the idea that they needed this overall golden governing narrative, and they shaped it to suit their purposes. And then anybody who didn't really fit into that, so basically women who were too outspoken, the idea of women voting, gay, lesbian, etc., they all got pruned around the edges. And that pruning took the form of some pretty stringent laws. Because it wasn't actually gay. It wasn't actually illegal to be gay until sort of Queen Victoria came back to the throne. And that was something she endorsed quite heavily. Being a lesbian, she didn't believe it existed. You know, it was natural affection.
That's my favourite bit.
Natural affections amongst women, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, that's okay, but people weren't that stupid. They knew. So either it was being completely erased, or in places where people were disgusted by the idea, those women were being subjected to correctional rape under the understanding that there was a natural order and it's a woman's natural place to submit to a man.
Yeah.
So, you know, ignoring the issue kind of left people vulnerable. And on the other hand, you had gay men being imprisoned.
Yeah.
This isn't a biography of Victoria, and she is a fascinating person. She wasn't a bad queen at all, but I don't think she ever really wanted to be queen in her younger days, and it really shows. I could go off on a tangent about Prince Albert, but I'm not going to.
No.
we're looking at the era overall. But yeah, it is that narrative, and unfortunately that narrative is one that is sold to us today in the name of history, and some of it's accurate and some of it really isn't. And that narrative is one we then carry forward when we're looking at other periods of history, which means we're perpetuating this very stringent myth of women with no rights and no minds of their own and no educations, and there literally being no queer people before they thought to make it illegal. In the 1840s, I think it was.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, also, I think we also, and this is a real, is that we have this very strange perception that England was very white as well. That kind of persists today, and that. You know, it always takes me back. There's a joke in an episode of something called Psych, where they're putting on a play, Jack the Ripper, and one of the characters is a black man, and he wants to be in the play. And they're like, we can't really put you in the play because it's set in Victorian London. And the character just looks at the director and goes, so what are you saying? Black people hadn't been invented yet? And I really laughed because Victorian London was so diverse. It wasn't just the capital of England. It was the capital of half of the world. Okay? There were so many different people coming through it. It was an incredibly diverse place. And despite the fact that London and, you know, other big port towns in England were incredibly diverse in terms of the different cultures and people who were there, around the same time you get this massive being perpetuated that it was all white, despite the fact that it very much clearly wasn't. And they were just pretending it was.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think the thing is, when I hear somebody, not even talking about my own work, but talking about a piece of historical fiction, and they're saying it was really good, but this was inaccurate. I'm like, well, what do you mean? It's like, well, they used the name Tiffany. And I'm like, that was actually a medieval name. It was the anglicised form of Theophania from the Greek. So, yes, it's now used in perhaps less elite circles, shall we say. Today, and along with names such as Chardonnay, and people assume that it's coming from a particular time and place, but if you do a little bit of research, you'll find that actually that's a well-known medieval name. I wouldn't use it because for that very reason, because people would find it so easy to misunderstand, but it's there and it should be used if people want to. Things like sex attitudes, the idea that, you know, women always yielded rather grudgingly. And it's like, you've clearly not read anything from the medieval era. There's a little gap in the middle in the 1600s, and then anything during the Georgian era, where women were considered creatures of base instinct who needed regular sex in order to keep them in order. It was kind of like
it is also yeah. It's just
it was a husbandly Sorry. Duty to keep your wife kind of satisfied so she didn't go elsewhere.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing because in the mythology as well that you get in the Victorian period, this weird attitude toward women is really, really reflected. And again, I'm going to talk about fairies because I can. Fairies undertook a massive change in Victorian England, where they stopped being kind of particularly female fairies. They became very diminutive. They were sort of seen, not really heard, and they were barely seen. And, you know, they were a little bit, they were innocent, a tiny bit coquettish sometimes. But, you know, for the most part, these kind of creatures of great, you know, purity. And those that were not pure, those that were evil, were very, very ugly and kind of had a lot more sort of male characteristics. But the female ones themselves were very, very pretty, and it was either women or children. And this is the bit, like, the Victorians were getting super weird because there were lots of crossover there of this is the ideal woman, but also we're going to make it a child, and it gets a bit freaky. But you look back at the kind of the original material, and what happened was that the Victorians stripped these female figures of their sexuality in a lot of way. They completely stripped them of anything that had its own form of agency. And what they did was that for those characters that they couldn't strip of agency, they villainized. So Morgana Le Fay, for instance, is a great example of a character who was very heavily vilified during the Victorian period. Up until that point, I mean, there were varying accounts, but Morgana was a sorceress, certainly. She had her own kind of agency, but she wasn't necessarily a bad person. She did some not great things, but that was because not great things were done. And in other versions, she was actually, you know, very much on the side of Arthur. And there seems to be very little evidence in kind of early versions that Morgana had anything against Arthur at all. She just really hated Guinevere. So the Victorians kind of went, no, we can't have this woman who committed adultery and was a sorceress and is power onto herself. We cannot have her being good. Completely villainized her entirely, as well as removing a whole bunch of other women from Arthurian legends. And they did this time and time again of just really, really taking old stories and changing them and then putting them forward as if they'd always been like that in order to push their own narrative. And that's the really disturbing thing.
Yeah, and it is part of this whole idea of the Victorians not letting the facts get in the way of a good story, particularly if it served their purposes. And it's amazing, there is almost nothing that it didn't touch, and we've been sold it. I just want to talk a little bit about older women, which, you know, sounds dicey. Basically, when Madeline messaged me yesterday, she said, "What are you up to?" And I said, "I'm reading about 18th century adultery trials. It's really salacious." And you came back and called me a nerd, basically, which is fair.
I said, "God love you, you beautiful nerd."
You know, the nerd part is definitely fair.
You called yourself a nerd first.
I did. Anyway, this apparently is what I do in my coffee break. There really is no excuse for me at all. So I'm going to move on to what I was actually trying to get to. And that is the fact that the Victorians perpetuated this idea that the three stages of a woman's life were sort of when she'd emerged from girlhood and she was ready for marriage. So she was this young, innocent, ingenue type character waiting for the suitable husband. And then after that, she was, you know, the gentle matron, but, you know, not a creature of sexual desire anymore. And not a creature to be desired sexually, because once she had children, obviously, what was the point kind of thing. And then after that, it was middle age. and middle age was the same as being old, and then you're down into sort of cronehood, if that's even a word. But the point is that the idea was that women were viewed in almost entirely through the lens of men's sexual desire. And that's very limiting. And the fact that we're still weeding out bits of that from our zeitgeist to this very day. I mean, a lot of the stuff people are talking about with internalized misogyny, they're based on these attitudes. In fact, they're based on some much, much older attitudes from the courtly love era of the medieval period. But I won't go that far back. But they are based on the Victorians really doubling down and almost setting in stone this idea that, you know, you could be this if you're a woman, or you could be a whore kind of thing. And there was kind of no middle ground. Now, what's really interesting is a scant sort of handful of decades before that, it was considered extremely titillating. It was almost like this was porn for the 18th century to read about married women having affairs and being brought up on adultery charges. And reading the witness statements was kind of like getting your hand on a decent copy of Playboy or whatever it is that, you know, you like to beat off to. I shit you not. This is really... generally, if you read these witness statements, they're quite similar, but they're told in a very sort of explicit, almost pornographic way. They're quite erotic. And, you know, the doors are gently closed on certain aspects. Or they'll use the stock phrase, and he had use of her body carnally, etc. And this is all from maidservants or butlers or valets or whatever who happen to be peering through the keyhole. So it's the idea of this voyeurism being really quite sexually arousing. But what's really fascinating is that there were men who specifically targeted women in their early 30s and late 30s, particularly if they just had children, or they just had a child. There was considered nothing more sort of erotic than lying with a woman when she was sort of in the after confinement period, you know, so everything's all sort of patched up and mended, but she's still breastfeeding a very small child. Apparently that was a really big turn on. And then there's later, I mean it seems weird to us because we've inherited a lot of stuff from the Victorians. But at the time, there was nothing, and for husbands as well, there was nothing more stirring to the loins than seeing your wife breastfeeding your child. That was supposed to be, you know, that was it. So I'm having difficulty getting across the mindset, but seriously, if you're interested, go and dig this up and read it, because it's absolutely fascinating. It's an absolute mind blower, seriously. On the subject of older women, older women were considered very sexually attractive, more so than sort of young virgins in the 1800s. So yes, you had the certain type who were kind of like, oh yes, the young coquette, or the young innocent ingenue, or what have you. I would like to be the first to ruin her, or whatever you want to say. But there were also kind of like a vast majority of them were more, I would rather have an experienced woman who knows what she's doing. And then at the absolute pinnacle of the salaciousness pyramid was an older woman, almost old enough to be the man's mother, considering everyone had children much earlier then, or generally, was a young man of sort of 18 or 19, just emerged from the schoolroom under the guardianship of his tutor, being seduced by a woman of 35 or of 39 or whatever, and shown the ways of the world. And the idea of this woman sort of taking this, I mean, can you taking this young man who's sort of the doe-eyed innocent? It's a complete reversal on the idea of the man always being the seducer. And apparently that was the absolute pinnacle of eroticism during the 1800s. You have to really look and do your research, though, because this is there, this attitude to sex, and the fact that the Georgians were really, really bawdy. They did not pull their punches about sex. There were sex jokes. If you read Jane Austen's letters, she makes quite a few puns, shall we say, and sex jokes herself. So don't assume that a decency of behaviour when we talk to each other. I mean, you wouldn't go up to a complete stranger and start talking about dick length, would you? So they did have that. Well, I mean, I hope you wouldn't. So they had that. They had that basic common courtesy, but they weren't the Victorians. They weren't repressed about any of it.
Yeah. This has been a mind blow. I mean, like, I knew some of this stuff, but
breastfeeding being the big erotic turn on it was as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that there are still certain circles where that is still the case, and there's definitely circles where older women and young men is still the case. I think they're called cougars.
Now they've been given that. I mean, it was something you could be fined for and taken to court for, you know, adultery. It was actually a legal issue in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Reading the adultery trials and the witness statements, that's kind of like, well, the porn doesn't get any better than this. You can forget your woodcuts, you know? I cannot stress how much of a mind opener this one was. I am a delight in an education, obviously. Aren't you glad you that are. I bring these things to you?
I'm so. It's been.
Anyway,
yeah,
so
that's wonderful. Thank you.
What does this have to do with speculative fiction? Well, what it has to do with speculative fiction is that art reflects nature, and then nature starts to reflect art. And if all you're doing is buying your historians from one narrative that was given, so you're perpetuating these myths. You're perpetuating the idea that, you know, there weren't really any queer people about, or that women had no rights whatsoever, or that women were sexually repressed, delicate creatures who couldn't look after themselves. And mm-hmm. that by breaking that mold, you're creating a character outside the norm. When in fact, you're not. You're really just creating sort of like one of 60% of the population kind of thing. And there's a problem with perpetuating these attitudes, I think. I think it's time for a broader understanding of both the Victorian era and everything that came before.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think you're right. I kind of want to, because we've looked a lot at sort of the historical side of the Victorian era. And I want to talk, before we go, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the novels that were coming out of the Victorian period, which also really affected our general view. And actually also maybe how they were influenced by that kind of romantic era, which has all sorts of weird strings attached. And I don't think that we can talk about that without mentioning the Gothic.
No, absolutely not.
So the Gothic is probably a term that a lot of our listeners will be familiar with. The Gothic is comprised of romance and horror mixed together. A little bit about the origin of the Gothic. You know, it comes from Goths. It was originally a form of architecture, and it was meant to mean barbarism, or something which is old, but which is kind of fighting against a certain grain. And its use for literature came from the castle of, was it Otranto? The castle of Otranto.
Yes.
By Horace Walpole. And he jokingly called it an archaic, a Gothic text, because it was meant to be this faux medieval story. And it was popular enough that, you know, he kind of started a bit of a movement, and the term Gothic came into vogue, as it were.
Yeah.
And it came to mean this very specific set of tropes, which were looking at the kind of the real horror of the world, but also were very focused on the taboo and sexuality was a huge part of the Gothic. And in particular, there was this big focus on forbidden sexuality. So taboo relationships, which kind of got more and more extreme. So this could be both consensual relationships and unconsensual relationships. So you might have things like incest. You definitely had things like rape, but you also had homosexual relationships. The picture of Dorian Gray, for instance, not explicit, but anyone who was reading the book at the time would basically be able to understand that Dorian Gray was causing a great scandal because he was having sex with a lot of men. Probably some women as well, but it was mostly men. He was being a true bisexual, doing what he wanted, basically experimenting and having a lot of fun. Not that that's the essence, but you know what I mean. The Gothic was weirdly enough, it was another form of great titillation, where what happened was that they were able to sort of really discuss these secret and hidden desires, which had this kind of wall of shame. And the reason they were able to do it was because it was presented as the darkness of humanity. And it has this horror aspect. It was always contrasted by something kind of pure. This damsel in distress, the innocent, you know, against the very negative, you know, sexually driven side. And I think Dracula's probably a great example of that, because you've got Dracula ticks all the boxes for these Victorian fears, because it was, you know, the unexplored East with Dracula himself and this foreigner invading England. Yeah, England that was invading everywhere else, but now England is being invaded. And he had these kind of three sisters / wives, who knows, and they were very sexually driven, and they get staked, you know, very phallic forms of death as well. And then you have the very innocent Lucy Westrow, who's so innocent and so kind and so wonderful, and she has three admirers who all desperately in love with her, but she very gently has to say no to two, and oh, they don't mind because she's just so wonderful and they just want her to be happy. And you know, she's managed to get all of these admirers, but she's the pinnacle of innocence. And then becomes this kind of sexual being which they then have to stake. So it's really ticking all of the boxes for forbidden, hidden desires and fears, which within the Victorian period were very, very closely knit together.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of the sort of Gothic novels, and certainly the 19th century novels with a Gothic bent, do quite a good job of giving you a bit of an insight into the mindset of the era too. So if we were to take, for example, Wilkie Collins' Woman in White, which, honestly, I've got a bit of a love-hate relationship with Wilkie Collins, because he's such a timorous character portrait artist for women. However, in The Woman in White, you've got Laura, who is the younger, beautiful sister with wealth, obviously, and standing, who is, you know, she's just good. She's just almost unquestioning good. Goodness, sweetness, lightness, etc. And ends up married to a man who is an absolute monster, because she won't break a promise she made to her father before. And then you've got Marianne, who is kind of like a representation of this enlightenment that's going on. She's inquiring, she investigates. It's very noticeable that Marianne's ugly and doesn't marry, and yet is much admired for her rigorous manly brain, etc., etc. One of the biggest compliments I've ever seen in a Victorian novel paid to a woman was Count Fosco, who is the real bad guy here, who says, "With such a woman at my side, I would snap my fingers at the world," because he's sort of saying that if I had someone of her intellect beside me, I could basically take the world apart and remake it in my image, which is a huge compliment, and at the same time, super, super creepy, because he's kind of got a thing for her all the way through. Even though he's married and his wife is like right there. But aside from the way that the women are portrayed, and the fact that yes, they actually kind of go outside this very stringent Victorian system of society and rules and decent behavior in order to right a great wrong, which is what they end up doing, aside from that, which I suppose was quite a ballsy thing for Wilkie Collins to write at the time, you get the reason they're put into this position is because the Women's Property Act isn't enforced. Therefore, Laura's wealth, her inheritance from her father, is in the charge of her uncle until she comes of age at 21. Her uncle basically just wants to marry her off and get rid of her and her sister out of his house because he does not want anything really to do with them. So he is no real guardian to her. He's no real support to her. And then when the lawyer is sat down with him saying, we need to work out a marital settlement here. We need to know how much of her wealth and her property is being protected for her, unaccessed by her husband. But her uncle doesn't want anything to do with it. And the lawyer even says at one point during the book, it's presented almost like a series of witness statements for an inquest. And he says, never in the world would I have any daughter of mine married under such a settlement. I mean, it's in such it's so badly phrased. It's so thoughtlessly done that Laura is put entirely in this man's power. And she has no recourse. We know that that ends badly because he has her shut up in an asylum. He fakes her death, shuts her up in an asylum, pretends she's somebody else and has her drugged out of her mind. And she recovers, but never fully. So it was a real kind of, you know, you need to look after your daughters. A typical marriage contract at the time included things like how much a woman could expect every quarter in terms of ready cash, in order to clothe herself and go on outings or to dispense with charitably. And it was money that she was entitled to that her husband was not allowed to ask her about. And that was the bare minimum of expected care. Now, if you don't put those things into place during this time period, when the Women's Property Act had not yet been enforced, then a man could marry a woman, take all her wealth, and if they had children, he could take the children as well. And then he could literally throw her out on the street and nobody could do a thing about it. If he decided he wanted to chuck her out of the house and let her fend for herself, or throw her into prostitution, or lock her up in an asylum, nobody had the right to gainsay him. So, these books are important because they do give you a slice of perhaps the extremes, but the fact that, you know, there was some serious legal injustices going on because the law had then been very deliberately skewed against women in order to preserve the illusion that they were these delicate creatures who needed to be closeted, cared for, and disciplined.
Yeah.
Let's not forget that it was still legal to beat your wife as long as the instrument of correction was no thicker than the width of your thumb.
Hence the rule of thumb.
Yeah. Now, we can't assume that everybody was like that, just like you can't assume in the medieval era that women were forced into marriage and they were immediately raped by their husband, because it just didn't happen, and most people are actually quite decent.
Yeah.
But the fact that in the Victorian era these things sort of were in place in law and most people couldn't really see anything wrong with them is a real issue, and you don't want that tainting the pool for the next lot of fiction inspired by it, or speculative fiction coming from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Weirdly enough, it makes me think of Frankenstein, which for me is actually a weirdly feminist text, despite the fact it has almost no women in it.
Elizabeth Frankenstein is very marginalised, isn't she?
Yeah, she's sort of there, and then she dies. She doesn't really have much to do with the story. But for me, it's a very, very feminist text because it's actually a conversation about men taking over women, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And men basically not seeing the value of women. As well as, I think, you know, it came from an element of grief in terms of the fact that Mary Shelley had lost several children up until this point, had some severe miscarriages that almost killed her. And all whilst this was happening, her husband was just sleeping around with other people. Now, technically, they had an agreement where that was okay. They believed in free love, as it were. But for a man that she was totally, totally in love with, having gone through these very horrific things, you know, he was then basically seducing her sister. So that can't have been very fun. And so she writes this story about a man filled with so much hubris that he wants to make another human being. And instead of doing it the, I don't know, ordinary way of getting married, he has to do it himself. And of course, it's a complete disaster because he goes wrong. He breaks lots and lots of laws. And then ultimately, he abandons his creation. He abandons his child. And for me, that's very much Mary Shelley saying, you need women. You need women. Now, in doing so, she's kind of also ticking boxes of what would be expected of women as, you know, mothers and caregivers. But regardless, it feels like a feminist text and this angry kind of kick out, this angry sort of kick out toward this very male-centered society who would basically trying to pretend that women were not necessary and were kind of gearing towards almost kind of just shuffling them out onto the side and barely tolerating them as citizens. So I that's what I feel about Frankenstein. A lot of people, you know, there's lots of ways you can read it, but I certainly think that Mary Shelley, who was a feminist of the time, who'd been, you know, was the daughter of a feminist, and who went on to do some pretty amazing things in terms of sort of fighting that fight, that was reflected in her work.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose, just thinking, moving on to something perhaps a little bit more modern, people who mm-hmm. used the Victorian setting and used it quite well, in my opinion, there's two examples. There's Gail Carriger, who mm-hmm. wrote the Soulless series. In this series, her main character is a preternatural, vampires, werewolves, etc. They're all out in Victorian society. This is a very steampunk book, by the way.
Yes.
But preternaturals are quite unusual, and basically anything supernatural that comes near a preternatural temporarily becomes human within her sphere of influence.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting, and she's sort of a bit of an outsider character, a blue stocking. She's mixed race. She's mixed race. I don't know. She might be considered mixed race of the time because she was half Italian. And
yeah,
quite dark skin and black hair. So depending on which circle you were in, Victorian England. So it's done really well. It she's obviously done her research. Another person who's done a really good job of it is Kara Jorgensen, who's got a series called The Ingenious Mechanical Devices, which kind of flirt with steampunk, but really they're kind of alternate Victorian history with a little bit of supernatural in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which are very interesting. Her books are very queer, and they're reflective of the attitudes of the time, and she really does her research. So she's not perpetuating this golden age of Victorian mythology and the attitudes towards women and sort of like, you know, the men were men and women were grateful kind of thing. It's being challenged, and when you feel that, for example, one of the female characters wants to be an artificer, but people won't take her seriously because she's a woman. And you don't feel that it's one of those typical, oh yes, she's a woman, unlike all the others who's had to overcome this, etc., etc. What you actually feel is genuinely frustrated for this person who just wants to do a job.
Yeah.
You never get the not like the other girls sort of feeling from it.
Oh, good.
So yeah, I highly recommend that series. They're really, really good. I guess the importance is with these sort of speculative fiction type books is the fact that the research has been done. I'm turning into such a bear for research, but that's because I've spent the last year writing historical fiction, and I do think it's really important. I would say if you're going to be inspired by histories, for example, if you're going to be like inspired by the Wars of the Roses and write something like Game of Thrones, do your research mm-hmm. about everything, including the attitudes of the time. And that's where people usually fall down. They assume the attitudes yeah. of one time are the attitudes of all of them. And they're really, really not.
Yeah. No, absolutely not. And that, I think, is the big one. And once again, we come to that metaphor of the wall.
Yes.
And the fact
that the Victorians arrived on the scene and they built yeah. a massive wall. They said it was going to be the best wall ever. and we're going to put the rest of history on the other side and just curate it carefully. That's an interesting point, actually. Many of our historical texts and things, our understanding of history, came from texts written in Victorian England.
And yeah. And
they were telling a specific narrative. Their historians were telling a specific narrative. And anyone who fell outside of that kind of got derided and rejected. And it's only been in the last of 40 or 50 years that people have turned around and said, actually, that's why we're not really sure that's correct. We're going to go back and actually read the chronicles and things for ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was the same with mythology as well, where yeah. they curated mythology. I mean, folklorists were sort of created around that period where it was basically these people from the cities who suddenly went, we don't want this information to be lost. So they went to rural communities and noted down, you know, the beliefs and you know, the these old kind of bits of lore. But there was a fundamental misunderstanding often in what they kind of brought back and what chose to include. And some of the records are very good and some of them aren't. And I think one of the best examples of the fundamental misunderstanding, and I'm sure I've mentioned this before, is the use of the word little or we. So what would happen was that these folklorists would go out and they'd say, you know, tell us your secrets. And they'd say, oh, well, you know, you've got to be careful of the little folk, of the little neighbours, of the friendly neighbours, of the wee folk. And they went, aha, they're small.
No.
Completely misunderstanding. That no, in much the same way that we use little to actually mean the opposite, such as Little John in Robin Hood. No one actually hears the word Little John and thinks he's little. It's ironic. They would do the same when it came to a lot of the figures in, you know, from mythology and from belief. So fairies being little, a part of that very, very, very well may be the fact these folklorists just completely misunderstood this tradition of calling them little in order to actually mean that they were big.
I'm kind of getting...
And from that...
Sorry, carry on.
No, and from that we have so much literature.
Well, Tiny Tinkerbells.
Yes.
I'm kind of getting the impression you would like to do another episode on fairies, so should we just bite the bullet at some point in the future?
Look, it's coming, okay?
It's been three years. I think you're owed one.
Yay! I'm sorry, but we couldn't talk about the Victorians without mentioning fairies. I just had to.
No.
And anyway, on that note, I do think we've run out of time.
we should wrap it up there, I think. Basically, yeah. We've just given you a little bit of a summation on not why you should distrust the Victorians, but why you should look a little bit beyond them.
Yes.
Certainly if you're intending to draw from history in your own writing. And we will leave it there because it would be a massive, massive book if we tried to discuss every single aspect of it.
Yes, absolutely.
Hopefully you've had a flavour.
And we hope you've enjoyed it. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And even though Jules technically does have one for you, I'm going to steal the spot and recommend a book of my own. Jules, if you will permit me.
Okay.
She wasn't expecting this.
No.
So I've recently been reading this really, really great series. called The King's Knight. It's by an author some of you may be familiar with. Her name is J.A. Ironside.
You can't see my face right now, but...
I knew if I told you I was going to do this, you'd say no. So I had to blindside you. And recently, this amazing author has released...
How much am I paying you again?
Has released the third installment of her historical fiction series. That is Tyrant. And I've just been in love with this series from the get-go. I've mentioned the first book before. Historical fiction is a bit hit and miss with me, but this has been a definite hit. So basically, if you love Jules's writing, you're going to love this series. And if you like misanthropic, grumpy knights who just kind of want to sleep and rest, but also kind of want to fight everybody, getting into insane situations with very weird kings and tyrants and plots and women who are way smarter than him and tiny, very cheerful little urchins. You should definitely read this series. I guarantee you will love the characters, you will love the writing, and you're going to love some of the historical cameos who come in there, particularly, and I've got to give a shout out to him, Chaucer, who was only meant to appear very briefly at the beginning of book one and has somehow inserted himself into the whole series as one of the main characters. I seriously recommend it. Go and check out The King's Knight by Jules if you haven't already. It's brilliant.
Oh, thank you very much for that.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.